Hey everybody, this is Michael Olivata speaking. What we're about to listen to here is going to be quite a rough ride. Essentially, this is the very first episode, the premiere episode of what will now be called the Adventures on Infant Island podcast, which will be exploring two generations of movie geekdom from the perspective of two very, very different souls. Essentially, it's going to be one older perspective introducing a much younger perspective on geek classics, movies, TV shows, anime, what have you, and seeing what happens. Once again, I just want to go ahead and disclaim here that what we're about to hear was recorded about a few days ago, and so we hadn't quite 100% formulated what exactly was going to be said, so there's going to be a pretty loose format this time around. Not only that, you'll also hear that the podcast had a different name, so don't be thrown off. What I'm going to say is Geek in Training. That's not the case. It's going to be Adventures on Infant Island, and I hope you enjoy it. Have a good one. Michael Olivares is here, also known as Wintermuted, and welcome to Geek in Training, a series is focusing on one generation of geekdom, bestowing the gates to hopefully a new one. The object of the game here is to introduce one cultural phenomenon, film, book, manga, movie, and bring it over to a completely new and young perspective. And co-hosting with me here will from now on be none other than the star of the short film Balance, which is featured on my YouTube channel, as well as Genki Language Girl, and purveyor of languages, ideas, the occasional idol boy, and talk monster du jour, Jenny Park. Hi, Jenny. How's it going?
Hi. I'm doing good. How about yourself, Mike?
Pretty cool. I can see you right across the way.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
It's okay. Don't worry. This is radio. You don't have to describe too much. But the idea being behind this is something that's been brewing between not only you and me, but us and several other friends over the last year. It's been something that we've been trying to do since the inception of Variable Zero, which is the mother site for Wandering Kaiju. The idea being behind this one was that the two of us have been having endless conversations about anything from pop culture to philosophy to, you know, the social world, and it just seemed natural that we would have to share these discussions because, frankly, there's so many great things that come out of it. It just seemed a crime for us not to try and keep them somewhere for all to listen to one day or be worried from. Either way, Jen, tell me a little bit about yourself. We want to hear a little bit about who you are, where you come from before you and I met, and what your interests are. Talk to me.
Well, of course, my name is Jenny Park, and I'm of Korean and Chinese descent. And I was born in Los Angeles, but grew up in Orange County. And before I met Mike, I was just, you know, going to school and just kind of like occasionally obsessing over like idol boys from Asia, and like and also watching movies and listening to various music. But my passion from the very beginning was different cultures and languages, and that started when I was like in the fourth grade back in elementary school, and it just snowballed from there. And once I met a friend, like in middle school, he was an anime fan, old school anime fan to be exact. Mm-hmm. He introduced me to anime directly and indirectly. And this might be really weird, but Macross soundtrack was the one that did it. I don't know why, my ears really loved the theme song. and that you know, introduced me to Rama One Half, and from there I kept on meeting like geek friends that like movies and anime and music and such, and that kind of made me, you know, open up the world to bigger things, not just idols.
Yeah, one of the really stranger elements to this entire thing was the fact that, you know, not only did we meet under the weirdest circumstances, which we can explain at another time, but that, you know, her obsessions were so different, and even though she herself was a movie fan, it was very, very unusual to come in with all of this stuff that I had, and... you know, eventually, you know, was going to be something to be mined from time to time. So the object of this entire show is her discovery of many of the things that, you know, brightened my days growing up and seeing it through her eyes. The focal point of this show particularly going to be nostalgic movies. And one of the big ones that we played over the last few weeks, most notably from the 80s, was going to be the Robert Zemeckis fantasy hit Back to the Future, made in 1985, co-produced by Steven Spielberg, written by Bob Gale, along with Bob Zemeckis. And it's become kind of a mainstay in the house over the last few weeks, and it only felt natural that we had to go ahead and discuss the film here and at maybe some length and find out what it is exactly that makes this film such a... an enduring, some dare might call it a classic, and why. So, with that said, I could go ahead and speak on and on about what I like about the movie even now, even if it's a snapshot of a time that, you know, it's no longer with us. Jenny, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, I know that you had seen the films before as a kid, right?
Yes, I was very little. I was, you know, barely, like, couple years old, and I watched it with my cousins, you know, sometimes, you know, when there's a get together, but, you know, it was just nothing more than like a fun packed film that everybody just watched with families and friends and whatnot. But I didn't really, you know, take it seriously. I didn't really analyze anything until just recently.
Oh, so what do you think now that you've seen it after all these years? What are your feelings on the movie now?
It's funny because, like what I told you before, when I was, you know, little, my favorite was the second one because, you know, it was, like, enjoyable to the eyes, and I was young back then. I didn't know any better. But now that I've seen three of them all at once, I would have to say that the first one captured me the most because there was a story going on, and I was able to really be in love with the characters. Not just, you know, liking what I'm seeing. It's not just eye candy, but I really like the characters a lot, and I've just fell in love with them. And I think I'm more sophisticated in movie viewing, so I don't look at movies the same as I used to. So I think that's the big difference there.
Well, most specifically, what is it about the original that you think keeps you going back?
It's just the story, like what I was saying, and the characters. I just love all the characters, especially Marty and Doc. And, you know, I want to know more about them. Every time I see it, I want to know more about them. And essentially, it's the characters. I think that's the only way I could put it for now.
Okay, well, you know, for those not familiar with the movie made in 1985 to great cable and video and cinematic endurance after all these years, the simple premise is the adventures of a young teenage boy who has a friend who is considered a local eccentric scientist who creates what is essentially a time machine, and in a fracas accidentally switches on the machine to wind up in a past version of his hometown 30 years before, as a matter of fact, and not only being able to go back in time to see the world of the 1950s, but to accidentally interrupt the meeting of his parents, thereby putting his existence in jeopardy. Now, the film being an adventure comedy, it's something that could easily have just been, you know, a very cheap throwaway kind of, you know, science fiction comedy like so many special effects movies of that time. It actually is quite intricate in what it's trying to set up. It's one of those movies that you just wouldn't see made now, because it actually takes about 25 to 35 minutes going in order to set up the story. And that's all exposition, not in regards to just the science fiction aspects, but in respects to Marty McFly's family life, the situation that they are in before Marty goes back in time to change everything. And so the effects of this movie probably come from the fact that we spent enough time to get to know everybody before we had a chance to screw with everything, as it were. And you know, I don't know. I mean, do you see any of this kind of thing happening at all in the sequels, or do you think it's only the first movie that does this?
Well, like what we've been discussing in the last 2 weeks or so, I think the second one kind of misses it a little bit towards the beginning, but like halfway through the movie, you know, they kind of lost track, and I was like very distracted by all the colorful things that I was seeing, and it seemed like I was just seeing too much, and my mind just couldn't really take in what was going on. But like after maybe 40 minutes into the movie, you know, it kind of went back to its originality again, and then, you know, I was thrown away to the world that really captured my heart from the first one. And then the third one, it kind of came back to what it's supposed to be. But the beginning of the second movie, yeah, it wasn't what I kind of expected. So I have to say that the first one is my favorite.
Okay, well, if that's the case, you know, other than the main relationship between Marty McFly and Dr. Emmett Brown, now played beautifully by Christopher Lloyd, were there any other elements from the setup of the film that, you know, again, you feel that are missing in the sequels that you like a lot?
Like the relationships of Marty McFly's family.
That's right.
Like, for instance, with the dad and the mom, and like, for instance, George was like a very how do I say it? He gets pushed around a lot, and he doesn't know how to say no. But like, you know, after all that happened with, you know, the time machine, you know, at the end, there was an altered future where, you know, Biff was, like, on the other end being weak, and George, you know, had all the power. But, like, at the beginning, you know, you see that, you know, he gets pushed around by the people around him. And also, I was able to see relationships between, you know, him and his mom, and also, like, later on when he goes back to the 50s, you know, he meets Uncle Joey. You know, the guy that's you know, in prison all the time, and he was like in a little crib with the bars, right? I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, there's some things that, you know, can be changed, and some things that just never do change. But in regards to the whole movie's dramatic thrust, it's really all about Marty's relationship to his parents and the plight that they're living under, which is very kind of atypical of a regular family in America. It seems to be something that Zemeckis and Gale are kind of commenting on.
And then another thing that they show indirectly was like the economic situations at the time during the 80s, like Reaganomics, and also just a regular American suburb in life. You know, I was able to see two different versions of American suburban life, like in the 80s and also the 50s when he goes back to the 50s. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting, too, learning about the 80s and the 50s at the same time in one movie. And also, you know, like what we're talking about before, you know, wanting to know about how our parents acted when they were kids. That's another thing.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest draw, probably, of the entire first movie, is the idea of, like, well, if you had a chance to go back in time and see what your mom and dad were like before they met or when they fell in love, would you have the same feelings about them that you do now? And I think that, you know, time travel movies had often just been about going to some sort of either an excuse to go to London or go to some sort of weird fantasy place with green painted guys in, you know, blonde wigs, and it was always completely absurd. And what's really awesome here is it's almost told like a joke, like a stand-up comedy joke. And it's true, is you go there and now you realize, oh crap, these are the people that made me, and what would happen if you got in the way. And of course Zemeckis and Gale come up with the best possible problem that this proposes. What if you got in the way of your parents meeting, thereby turning one of your parents, in this case Marty McFly's mother, her eyes toward him and having her in love with him?
Mm-hmm.
And to make matters worse, he's realizing now that he's messed this up, he's running on very limited time in order to get them back together.
Yeah, and also, like, you know, the photo that he showed to Doc, right, with him and his brother and sister, right? You know, it, you know, as the time passes, you know, the brother gets erased, and with the sister, you know, you only see the body and the head's gone. And the Doc tells him that if you don't hurry it up, you know, it's your turn. You won't be able to see yourself in that photo. And then when he was performing the Johnny B. Goode song, it seemed like, you know, something was kind of going wrong with him, and one of the band members was asking him, you know, what was going on, you know.
Well, by that point, everything else had been erased. He was running out. The whole movie is a big... Okay, one thing that's important for you to remember in movies of this kind, particularly, especially genre movies, is there's almost always what is called the ticking clock. You need something that's going to happen. If your heroes cannot beat this clock, they're going to lose. It gives the audience and everybody something to get behind the hero for. He needs to hurry. And the ticking clock in this is in the form of a really weird conceit, which is, you know, it's completely silly. I mean, it's, you know, to look at a photo to gauge, you know, how much time you have left, like an hourglass, it's really silly, but somehow in this movie it completely works. Because it sets up its own logic. And again, just a little aside about, you know, fans who nowadays have to nitpick everything, they need to often remember and understand that if your characters aren't that interesting, people will always fall back on logic lapses, or very often anyway, I apologize, will fall back onto logic lapses to explain what it is that's causing the problem, why they're not enjoying the movie. And in this case, the characters were so good. The character dilemmas were so great, and the arcs are so well constructed that they hardly ever notice just how silly the whole photo thing is. And, you know, so again, you know, the premise of meeting your parents, parental interruptus, whatever you want to call it, then and having now Leah Thompson gunning for what is a, you know, potentially Freudian territory, and you know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And of course, yeah.
And I would have to say that you know, when you know, Lorraine Baines, his mother, in the future, she was going all goo goo gaga over her potentially future son. And for some reason, it was just so weird to me, you know, when I was seeing her all, you know, goo goo gagaing over, you know, Marty instead of George.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's such a revealing thing about being a teenage girl in the 1950s, I think. That's another kind of thing that's interesting to see from the eyes of someone who grew up in the, you know, in the 80s or early 90s, who, you know, they still, you know, there are women in America who still exist. They still grow up to feel that what they want to be in life is to be not a career woman, not a student, but to be a bride, and to, you know, and basically they're just boy crazy. And Lorraine Baines is an incredible example of being totally boy crazy. And, you know, and even though she was like this when she was older at the very beginning of the film, again, this is all exposition, she claimed she never did any of these wild things.
Yeah, when, you know, she was conversating with her daughter, you know, she was pretty much saying that, you know, chasing over a boy or calling a boy is not good, but she herself did it. So I thought that was kind of hypocritical for her to lecture her daughter about, you know, chasing after somebody. And she did the same thing, you know, when she was in high school.
Well, again, that's kind of something
I think all parents are that way, though. I mean, they would say, oh, well, you know, when I was your age, you know, I never did this, I never did that. But then when you really, you know, look at it, they pretty much did what you were doing now, you know.
So I think
all teenagers go through that, you know, and when they, you know, become adults, they kind of close that mindset and totally forget about the wild things that they used to do. But that's part of growing up, though. So, you know, I guess I'm not going to say anything bad about Lorraine, you know, doing what she did when she was in high school.
But here's the funny part, okay? This is where it gets really funny. The movie doesn't stop there with just Lorraine. It also does this with the father, George McFly, played by Crispin Glover, which I think is very, very funny. Instead of denying anything that he had been guilty of doing, she basically asks him, what were you doing when you were hit by the car? When, you know, was it bird watching? And instead of him saying he would never do anything like, I don't know, carry binoculars, get on a tree trunk and
he's
watch
her. He's a peeping Tom, really.
Yeah, so, but his response is not that he never did it. It's a simple, what, Lorraine? What? You know, as if he never heard it. He didn't hear a thing, so therefore he's not guilty. So, mothers will tend to deny everything, mm-hmm. and the guy will pretend that he's completely ignorant and not know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, again, that was a really, really small but very, very funny thing that was placed into the script, and I totally loved that movie for it. And again, as a kid, when I first saw it, when it first came out, I liked the scene, that I didn't know why I liked it, and now, many years later, you know, watching this, I don't know how many times now, I totally love that dynamic, because now you get to see the way your parents were versus the way they are. And of course, in typical Frank Capra, Zemeckis fantasy style, we get to see how things change now that you have an interloper from in a time machine and to mess with things with the help of your 1950s version of the Doc. and again, it's just one of those stories that it shouldn't work in regards to being a more scientifically hard science fiction kind of person. But this movie is not necessarily about science or about hardware or anything like that. It's really about the relationships, and I think that the audiences back in 85 and the audiences ever since, they know what's really being talked about here.
And to top it off, I think the Back to the Future movie is such a geek classic, or just classic in general, because, you know, anybody could enjoy it. You don't even have to be a geek to enjoy it. It seems like it's made for geeks and just mainstream audiences, you know. And that's a clever thing about Back to the Future. Anybody could enjoy it. And also, it doesn't feel like as dated as some 80s movies. Even though, like, in fashion and music, you can sense that it's an 80s movie to the core. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, people from any generation can possibly enjoy this awesome trilogy. That's my opinion on it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess maybe for my part, as much as I do like the sequels, to mm-hmm. me, they're to a much lesser degree, mm-hmm. kind of like an unsuccessful thing along the lines of the Matrix trilogy,
mm-hmm.
where they're clearly made to make money for Universal, which made a lot of money with the first film. They really were never intended that way.
Mm-hmm.
But again, back to the first film, it's a complete movie. There doesn't need to be any sequel after it. It's got all the setup, it's got mm-hmm. all the humor, and it's got all the character arcs that you could possibly want in three movies in one movie.
And another thing that I liked about the movie was the music.
You're talking about the soundtrack or the...
Soundtrack, yes.
Are you speaking of specifically of the 50s tunes or the 80s tunes? Or
both.
Or how about the Alan Silvestri score?
I think that was awesome, too. You know, I've been humming it a lot these days. You know, whenever I'm doing something or when, you know, I need to, like, cheer myself to, you know, do something, you know, really awesome, that song will come into mind and I will start humming in the background.
One other aspect that I really want to give more time to is going to be, once again, back to our two leads, Michael J. Fox's Marty McFly is hilarious and a really good and likable unlikely hero. But the real hero of the entire trilogy, let alone the first movie for me, has always been Dr. Emmett Brown, played by Christopher Lloyd. Now, I don't know exactly 100% what your thoughts on the character are, and if you found him just as fun as I've always found him, but I don't know, what do you think?
Well, for me, my favorite character was Marty, and my second favorite is Doc. But they're about the same, but then if I were to choose who's first, it would be Marty, but I still like them, you know, both a lot. Yeah, because I think they're like the center, you know, center of the story itself. So.
Okay. Well, what exactly about Marty is it that you like him so highly?
I like him because it seems like he, like for instance, like his dad, you know, couldn't really stand up for himself, really, and even the future him, you know, as an old man, or rather his son, right? His son, there you go. His son in the future in 2015, he was sort of kind of like a weak person that gets pushed around like George McFly did. But, you know, Marty's sort of in between. He's trying to, you know, at least stand up for himself. Or, yeah, it seems like he's at least trying to make an effort to take action for himself, you know.
But in the first movie, I keep going back to this, in the first movie, what is it about him that you like? We're ignoring the sequels.
Okay. I like him because you know, I just feel like I can sort of relate to him. Like for instance, the rejection thing. You know, he's too scared to be, you know, rejected, you know, with his music, right? You know, he's a musician, but then he doesn't want to like sort of go for it because, you know, he has doubts and he's scared of rejection, and sometimes I feel like that. You know, there are things that I want to do, but I end up not doing it because I'm afraid of other people's like reactions, you know? So I can kind of relate to him on that regard.
Yeah, and I found it really fun that, and very revealing that his father is exactly the same way in 1955, would be science fiction author. In other words, I guess what they're trying to say is that kind of fearfulness kind of, you know, runs in the family. Sometimes it's actually taught from one parent to their child, and it can continue until someone decides to break that cycle. You know, so, and remember though, the counterpoint to this, you know, the alternate father that Marty has in the series really is going to be Doc Brown. Because no matter how crazy the town or anybody else thinks Dr. M. Brown is, he is still making it. He's still living the dream, no matter what anybody else
and
thinks.
And another thing that I like about Marty is it seems like, you know, at least, you know, he's trying to make things happen. Even if the people in the town are just indifferent and they're just, you know, living the normal 80s life, it seems like, you know, he wanted to do something different. That's the reason why he met up with, you know, Dr. Emmett Brown. I don't know how we met him exactly, but, you know, he met him, you know, obviously because he's, like, interested in science and, you know, different things in the world, you know? So that's an implication about, you know, Marty's character of wanting to be different and wanting to learn. And that's how him and, you know, Dr. Emmett Brown joined together and went on a journey on the time machine.
Yeah, it's almost like Doc is a second father for Marty in many ways. You know, he's a much more proactive person. Now, granted, he's proactive about things that most other people think are crazy, but regardless, he is proactive. And the ultimate achievement in this is the fact that he finally creates something that works.
It's kind of like a mentor and a disciple.
It's Merlin and Arthur. It's the sword and the stone. You know, we have those archetypes told constantly, but this is among the best of the big ones that have ever been told in the last, I would say, 30 years.
Science master and a student, you know, a person in training. And, you know, I thought that was really cool because, you know, it seemed like an ordinary 80s boy, you know, going on a trip on a time machine. You know, don't you think that's kind of unique for the time, you know? So that made me feel, you know, something special about Marty. He wanted to try something very different than most 80s kids wouldn't be doing, you know? That's the reason why I kind of liked them, you know? because he took initiatives somehow.
Again, he kind of falls back to wanting that cool Toyota 4x4 truck, but so I don't know.
And then I really like Doc because he's like an inspiration. That's another important thing. He's an inspiration, and he's like this, like what you're saying, he's a little bit crazy, but, you know, he likes to make things, and I like people that make things, you know, and people that are, you know, creative, and people that are an inspiration to people around him. And Doc is just that. Like what you were saying about him being a second father, I think Marty needs that kind of energy, because George, his father himself, can't be an inspiration because he's always been pushed around, you know. And Doc is one of those people that are proactive and that are out there to go get what needs to be done. And I think Marty just needs a little push like that. A little encouragement saying, hey, you know, if you want something, you need to go get it. You can't just sit around and be scared. So I think Doc is a good mentor.
Which leads me to spoiler territory for those who've never seen the film. But essentially, within the first 25, 30 minutes of the film, before the first major plot point of time travel ever occurs, Dr. Emmett Brown is killed by Libyan terrorists right before Marty shoots himself into 1955. Now, the entire film is spent with Marty trying to get back to 1985 with the help of a young Dr. Emmett Brown, and all the while thinking about the fact that his friend will be dead in 1985 unless he does something about it, in which case he does something in the form of a letter. But, of course, Doc won't hear anything of it because he believes that, you know, no one should ever know too much about their own destiny. So what do you think of that particular plot point throughout the whole movie, like how that must be?
You mean, like, not being able to see yourself?
Well, not just
paradox.
See yourself. No. More about not being able to know about your future, even if your future is going to be death at the hands of bad people. You know, there's nothing that Marty can do unless he thinks of something. And, of course, he writes that letter. So, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, it's like he loses his father, and now he has a chance to save him.
That's kind of a tough call, because it would just depend on the situations. For me, if something like that happened to me personally, I would have a hard time, you know, choosing, you know, what I should do. So that's a hard one.
Because on one level, it's like you want to respect your friend because he does believe this philosophy of time travel, you know, shouldn't be interrupted. Mm-hmm. But who's to say that something bad might happen if he saves his life? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the death that Doc suffered might have been the easier way out, albeit tragic, but the easier way out as opposed to an uncertain future where, you know, he has the time machine and, of course, the sequels happen.
Yeah, I mean, when there's, like, you know, sacrifice happening, it could be, like, a good thing. But, I mean, if he died, then there would be no sequel.
I guess we got to look at it like that. And it's
So maybe, you know, they probably planned that, too.
Well, it's also just a very sweet thing that, you know, at first it looks very much like at the finale, at the big, awesome clock tower finale, race towards the, you know, being able to get back with the bolt of lightning and the, you know, 1.21 gigawatts. The idea that Marty tries to put the letter in his coat pocket, and of course Doc discovers it and says no, and decides to destroy it. There's just something very incredible about that whole sequence, because it's hard to say whether, oh no, you know, at the end of the sequence, even if Doc survives this hairy situation, he's still gonna die in 1985.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but, like, I know that you don't really like the sequels very much, but, you know, but I'm glad that they're, you know, there's 2 and 3 as well, because I get to see the other side or other perspectives of the story. I mean, although it's not as good as the first one, definitely, but I'm kind of glad there's two and three in a way, so I can, you know, see other worlds of Back to the Future.
Yeah, the Hill Valley in all of its different versions, yeah. It is very cool.
2015, 1885, you know, those are pretty interesting.
And all the alternate 1985s that followed.
Yeah, yeah. But then I personally prefer the 1985 and 1955 in the first one. Yeah, yeah, and then I really love the... I really love Doc from 1955.
Yeah, he's my favorite out of the whole series.
I don't
series.
Know why,
yeah,
but that's just my opinion on that.
Yeah, I think a friend of ours brought up recently that he loves that one. Or actually, it's my brother. He's like, the idea that now that he knows that he will one day succeed and make something that works, that he has something to shoot for. So in a weird way, Marty inspires him, in which case it always seemed like maybe Brown was going to inspire Marty, but in this case Marty has a chance to inspire him to reach it, you know, by, you know, reminding him about the accident that caused him to see the flux capacitor in his head, and now to inspire him to say, you're going to succeed in making this thing a reality. And the comedy of course, of the fact that in 1955, you know, one would never believe that Ronald Reagan would be president or any of these other things. It's so chock full of really great ideas. That,
I think it's a good inspiration. Sorry to chop you off there, but I think it's a good inspiration for Doc, because, like, what goes around comes around, I guess, because once, you know, Marty goes back in time and inspires Doc, you know, in the 80s, like in 85, Doc is able to inspire Marty to kind of go out there and do his thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I think kind of goes both ways on that. And, like, you know how Doc was a little bit down for a while because he felt as if he couldn't really create anything that functions.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, this guy from 1985 from the future comes to 55 and shows him that, and he's like, wow, you know, I actually created this thing that works. Wow, you know. He was fascinated by that, and I was like, oh.
Yeah, it's just really, really, really cool. There's so much going on in that film, and if you haven't seen it, by all means, just dig it up. It's worth every cent. The original, and if you like, you know, if you really, really like it and you really want to see more, by all means, check out the later sequels, because they are enjoyable on their own terms. Okay, well, for the most part, that wraps this one up for the most part. However, for those who are curious, who are listening, is there any place we can find you on the internet?
Yes, you can find me on MagicWandGirl10 on Twitter, and also for Facebook is Jenny Park.
Oh, awesome. And okay, you can find me at wanderingkaiju.blogspot.com, as well as animediet.net, writing under the name Wintermuted, and of course on variablezero.yolasite.com. Again, you can also find me on Twitter at twitter.com/wintermuted. You know, that's it for today's episode. I hope you come back to check out some more Geek in Training. Have yourself a good one, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.